Now we return to a guest who's been on the program a number of times, Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. His major research area is the Middle East, special focus on Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and the Kurdish society. And Iran is certainly a name we will come back to in just a moment. Mr. Rubin, good evening.
Good evening.
Good to have you back on the program tonight. Your thoughts about the weekend massacre and what the administration has now essentially restated. I don't think there's been any new ground broken there as in far as our response and responses will be.
Well, as to the massacre, these sorts of outrages have become the rule rather than the exception. They should no longer surprise. The Assad regime has specifically targeted women and children in order to try to cow the population. Because of that, they've lost any hope of ever regaining legitimacy. At the same time, it's not enough in the face of an autocrat who's determined to hold on to power to simply warn him again and again he must leave power. The Assad regime has concluded that the United States is a paper tiger and that the gap between our rhetoric and our reality remains as great as it has ever been.
In fact, that's not a terribly unrealistic view on his part, is it?
No, it most certainly is not. He has in the back of his mind the fact that, unlike Libya, he has allies in Iran and Russia who are committed to arming him. We oftentimes forget that Syria is home to Russia's only military base outside the former Soviet Union. The Russian Navy has a base at the Syrian port of Tartus, and so Assad is calculating that that the Russians will simply never flip and abandon him because they're afraid of losing that military asset.
Now then, the phrase during Norah O'Donnell's reports was used, tightening the noose. To what extent are there nooses which can be tightened, and to what extent do they affect Assad and his ruling clique as opposed to the whole country?
The answer is the nooses might be constructed of paper. I mean, they're not strong. They're not really going to have any effect on Assad. First of all, the Syrian economy, after four decades of Ba'athist rule, first by Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, and then for the last 12 years by Bashar himself, is a shambles. It's not well integrated into the world economy. And because of that, sanctions simply won't have much effect. There's simply not that much to sanction. At the same time, the Assads come from a ethnic minority. I'm sorry, a sectarian minority, the Alawite whites, who are sort of a Shiite offshoot. And because of that, Assad can count on the loyalty of the senior generals and his cousins and all those whom American policymakers might wish would just stage a coup and be done with it, because there's a real fear that if there's a change at the top, the non-Alawi majority, the Sunni Muslim majority, will turn on the Alawis and simply massacre them. So Assad can count that no matter how tight that noose gets, it's not going to be able to fracture the loyalty at the top of his regime.
To what extent can and will Iran back Syria? Of course, Syria is important to Iran. It is the physical gateway from Iran into Lebanon, where Hezbollah plays such an important role. It has been an ally in a number of ways in recent years. So I guess Iran has something at stake here. I'm not sure what Iran can do.
Iran can do quite a bit. I mean, remember, first of all, you're absolutely right. Syria has traditionally been Iran's only consistent ally. During the years of the Iran-Iraq War, every single Arab country sided with Iraq, with the exception of Syria, which sided with Iran. So Syria is Iran's ally number one. Now, this is where the timing of the American withdrawal from Iraq becomes so unfortunate, because while we might at one point have talked about a no-fly zone, which could have hampered Iranian supply into Syria, now that the Americans don't have forces in Iraq, the Iranians can simply resupply Syria overland through Iraq. So in many ways, we snatched defeat from the jaws of victory in Iraq and prolong the conflict in Syria.
1-866-50-JIMBO is our number, 1-866-505-4626. One other question, which is not directly related to the topic tonight, but I've always been curious about it, and there you are, so I'll just ask. The Sunni-Shia split, one of the few things that most of us know at all about the Islamic world is that it's big, and here you've got Shia Iran, and I guess Syria is predominantly Sunni, right?
Correct, yes.
Then how come the love that extends there? I guess there's some things trump religious differences in that part of the world, but not much.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, here's the trick. You can look at any book about Islam, and it will tell you that 10% of Muslims are Shiite and 90% are Sunni. The problem is that between the Mediterranean through Iran, it's a 50-50 split, and that's why there's the sense that absolutely everything is in play. You add into the Syrian mix, however, the fact that 10% of the country is Christian, and the Christians have traditionally been very staunch supporters of Bashar al-Assad, and that also is going to be a looming concern to American policymakers, because if regime change comes to Syria, the population will turn on the Christians out of a sense of revenging and avenging their support of Bashar al-Assad. Now, the Christians supported Bashar al-Assad simply because they were a minority and they feared the Muslim Brotherhood and so cast their lot with what they considered the lesser of two evils.
And if you go back to the first Gulf War, a lot of people forget that Syria actually fought against Iraq. I'm not sure that you could call their presence there much more than token, but there it was. And yet Syria and Iraq at the time represented the only two countries in the world led by the Ba'athists, basically neo-Nazi philosophy in that part of the world. And at the time, I remember wondering what that was all about. So as we go to the break, perhaps you could explain to me why that occurred, why Assad's father actually fought against Saddam Hussein, at least nominally.
Well, if I can make an allusion to a film, it's like The Life of Brian, where you have the Judean People's Liberation Front and the People's Front for the Liberation of Judea, both of which only have two people, and each of which is just fighting each other. They were two rival branches of the Ba'ath Party, and they could never get over that rivalry. That's why they turned on each other. But in both cases, Iraq and Syria, the ideology of the Ba'ath, of Ba'athism has long since been eclipsed by just sheer personal totalitarianism on the part of the ruler.
More to come. 1-866-50-JIMBO. As you look at what is being done, what can be done, what likely will be done as regards the Syrian government and the ongoing year-long violence there that has now led to 108 people being massacred in one Syrian town over the weekend. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626 is our number. And again, in that volatile part of the world, trouble has a way of drawing people in. We'll be back. This is the Jim Bohannon Show. 1-866-50-JIMBO is the number. 1-866-505-4626. We're talking with Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, looking at just what is taking place regarding Syria now, with a whole lot of normally incompatible nations all getting together, ambassadors and other official diplomatic representatives from Syria expelled by the United States, Canada, Germany, France, Switzerland, the United Kingdom, Bulgaria, the Netherlands, Spain, Italy, and other nations. So a lot of Syrian diplomats are getting a one-way ticket home. Whether or not this will make Bashar Assad cry himself to sleep tonight, probably problematic. Let's take a call here for Michael Rubin from Mel in Billings, Montana. Good evening, Mel.
Yeah, good evening. I've been paying a lot of attention to this situation, and about a month and a half or so ago, when the Russians actually voted for the UN resolution, at the same time it was reported that the Russian Marines, a group of them, had landed on a Russian tanker in Syria, and that they were there to protect Assad from the, quote, terrorists. And I'm just wondering, I mean, this doesn't seem to be much of a deal to anybody. It's never talked about. Are they actively engaging militarily, or are they just sitting on the boat and, you know, having coffee and playing cards?
Interesting point. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a great question, Mel. The Russians do have that port, their base in Tartus, which is on the Syrian Mediterranean coast, just north of the border of Lebanon. Now, oftentimes that port is where the Russians are sending arms and equipment. And according to the Cypriots and the Turks, who follow maritime traffic in the eastern Mediterranean rather carefully, there have been a number of Russian arms shipments that have been going into that port. So it looks like that is where the majority of the Russian aid is going right now. But I would also say, if I could just add a separate point, while we're talking about how Western diplomats are kicking out, Western countries are kicking out Syrian diplomats, when Assad looks at how the United Nations is acting, he really, if nothing else, is convinced that he has nothing to fear. He has Russia on his side, Iran on his side. And what is Kofi Annan talking about doing? Sending in peacekeepers from Zimbabwe. I don't think Bashar al-Assad worries too much about the Zimbabwe army.
Probably not. Mel, anything you want to add?
Yeah, there's one other thing. The fact is, they made a big point of the fact that there were Russian Marines on that boat. And I'm wondering if that's military, that's boots on the ground. Are they actually in Syria in a part of any of these battles?
They're always, of course, especially back in the days of the old evil empire. I remember when the 1973 Middle East War came to a head and the Israelis were really kicking some major Egyptian butt, and things came to a halt pretty quickly. And Henry Kissinger hopped into the thing when the Russians essentially said either this comes to an end, or we'll send in Soviet military forces. And you had the very real specter of an honest-to-goodness major power Cold War head-to-head, eyeball-to-eyeball. We're not anywhere close to that here, are we, Michael?
No, short answer is no. The Russian Marines came in. There was a port call by the Russian aircraft carrier, and then many of the Russian Marines left. The boots on the ground that we really need to be worried about are General Qasem Soleimani's Quds Force. General Soleimani, of course, is the head of this elite unit of Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, and the Iranian press has been quite open that Qasem Soleimani is on the ground in Syria. And what we are worried about behind the scenes is that should American boots go on the ground, which I don't think is likely, or more likely Turkish boots go on the ground, then the Iranians and the Russians would be chomping at the bit to prolong this insurgency and make Syria a very, very bloody, complicated affair.
Thank you for your call, Mel, which raises, by the way, another interesting prospect here. To what extent are the Russians really prepared to do anything constructive here? I mean, to me, it strikes me as a lot like Iran, which Russia and China on occasion will mouth platitudes that sound like they're backing an end to the Iranian nuclear program. But you always get the feeling that in both cases, the leadership of Russia and China will gladly look way, way the other way. For example, to break an embargo. They might not officially break a trade embargo with Iran or, in this case, Syria, but they would certainly look the other way as private companies in their countries broke the daylights out of it. So to what extent are the Russians in particular willing to allow Assad to continue to be propped up here?
In short, the Russians are willing to do anything necessary to allow it to happen. If I can make an analogy, let's say Obama and Vladimir Putin were negotiating over an apple pie. The way things would work is President Obama would agree to give Vladimir Putin 90% of the apple pie in exchange for a very, very weak resolution at the United Nations. Once that resolution is passed and everyone pats himself on the back, Vladimir Putin would sneak in and eat the other 10% of the pie. And basically, we're not doing any good pretending that the Russians are going to reset.
Fair enough in that regard. More to come here as we look at various aspects of this entire situation now as the world is prepared to send nasty notes to Damascus to huff and to puff And we'll see if anybody is prepared to do anything beyond that, or if, in fact, the Syrian president, Bashar Assad, is prepared to listen to anything that low level in terms of response. 1-866-50-JIMBO, our number, 1-866-505-4626. On the Bohannon Show, we're talking with Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. They're online at aei.org. 1-866-50-JIMBO, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. What's going to be done about Syria? What should be done about Syria? What can be done about Syria? Michael Rubin is our guest, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. The Middle East is his bailiwick. To what extent is Bashar a chip off the old Hafez al-Assad?
Well, I mean, very much. Remember, Bashar al-Assad was the youngest son. No one ever expected him to take power, but his older brother and the heir apparent, Faisal al-Assad, was killed in a car accident. So Bashar al-Assad came back. He was, in the eyes of many diplomats, a great hope. He was a Western-educated eye doctor. Then again, this notion that Western-educated doctors have to be liberals and reformers is somewhat curious. After all, Papa Doc Duvalier in Haiti was a brutal dictator, but he was a Western-educated doctor, and Bashar al-Assad remained true to that pattern in which someone who is exposed to the West, rather than embracing Western liberalism, simply uses his time and his exposure in the West to learn how to deal with Westerners to pull the wool more broadly over their eyes.
Interesting. Now, I guess I'm in a conspiratorial mood. How accidental was that car wreck that killed his brother?
It was very accidental. I mean, the brother was young. He was a playboy. He knew no controls. He drank too much. He smoked too much. He liked really fast cars. And no one made him drive 100 miles per hour into a highway overpass. I mean, that was just his own typical Assad stupidity.
All right. Fair enough. Now, then, there have been, many thoughts regarding the appropriate Western response. Read that, I guess, in many cases, American response ever since Arab Spring broke out. And, of course, we did see the application of Allied air power in Libya, although some would call that, I guess, easy pickings. Libya didn't have much in the way of an air defense. I'm guessing that Syria has a considerably better one, although not enough to make a lot of difference here. When we draw comparisons with Syria and Libya, how valid are those comparisons?
Well, actually, the Libyans didn't have much of an air defense. The Syrians also don't have much of an air defense.
Okay.
The problem is that in Libya, you had the population much more concentrated along the coast. So you really were talking about an operation which could be primarily naval-based, should we want. You could really blockade the coast, launch aircraft if you wanted to from aircraft carriers, and take care of issues that way. In Syria, the problem is if you were going to have a no-fly zone, in effect, you would still need to deal with the helicopters, and so you'd have to have not just a no-fixed-wing aircraft zone, but no helicopters, no flying apparatus of any kind. But the real danger has never been the Syrian army. The Syrian Air Force. The real danger has been that the Syrians are willing to be very, very brutal with their army, with their armored personnel carriers and so forth. And so you would really need to enforce a zone in which no Syrian armor could go north of a certain line. Then you have a problem. What happens if they just pile into civilian SUVs? And are you going to start targeting civilian SUVs? You might need to. You'd need to have some sort of intelligence. But when we're talking about this scenario, in reality what we're doing is replaying 1991, with Operation Provide Comfort in Iraq, the operation that created the Kurdish safe haven.
Okay, 1-866-50-JIMBO is the number, 1-866-505-4626. 1-800-259-9226. And I'm curious about Turkey here. Turkey, a big neighbor, of course, a powerful neighbor, ostensibly an American ally, although there have been some Islamist leanings in recent years that have got a lot of people wondering about that. To what extent could or would Turkey play a role here? Because I suppose in the Islamic world, another Islamic state might play a bit better than a pack of infidels.
On one hand, Turkey is conflicted. On one hand, they are a sectarian power, and they would like to see the Sunni Muslim Muslim Brotherhood in power in Syria. But here's the problem. About 20% of Syria is actually Kurdish and not Arab, and many of those Kurds live near the Turkish border. When you look at the political divisions within Syrian Kurds, up to 90% of Syrian Kurds are loyal to a group called the Kurdistan Workers Party. By its Kurdish acronym, it's called the PKK, which has been waging a terrorist insurgency in Turkey since 1984. So on one hand, Turkey wants a regime change in Syria, but on the other hand, Turkey's afraid to put any boots on the ground or create a safe haven because they're afraid that it will become a safe haven for Kurdish terrorists that would attack Turkey.
And I guess if there's one thing that Turkey, Syria, Iran, Armenia, and any other neighboring states involved all agree on, it is that there cannot ever be an independent Kurdistan.
I think that's a pretty safe bet, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Now then, regarding the Kurds, of course, because they are a big factor here, obviously, just by their presence and the fact that they are out to get as much autonomy as they can, which, of course, in Iraq is pretty considerable, really, I guess, outside of foreign policy affairs. The northern part of that country is pretty much left to itself. And people forget that it hasn't been that long ago, if I'm not mistaken, that the Kurds so irritated the Turks that they actually sent troops into northern Iraq, did they not?
Indeed. It was just a couple of years ago. And again, the Turks were going after this group, the PKK, which has been launching attacks in Turkey and continues to. Just 2 days ago, the PKK killed 3 Turkish soldiers inside Turkey.
1-866-50-JIMBO. We talked to Mike in La Crescent, Minnesota. Good evening.
Good evening. I have a conspiratorial question for you.
Okay.
I heard some pretty substantial rumors during the Iraq conflict that some of those WMDs found themselves.
I have no idea. I swear to goodness, I didn't touch that, although that will only add to the conspiratorial notion. I think I can finish his question for him. There was talk as the Allied advance into Iraq was about to take place, that there was a caravan of vehicles seen going from Iraq into Syria, and so went the theory that some of the weapons of mass destruction may have gone to Syria. Certainly, we found plenty of indications when our forces went into Iraq that the nuclear program may have been shelled, but there were considerable efforts made in the direction of chemical and biological weapons. So, assuming that was what he was asking about, what about that? I never heard an explanation about that caravan, which I gather did exist, but the question was, what was it carrying?
You're absolutely right. You're right about the nuclear program. That looks like it had been shelved. But the caravan going from Iraq into Syria remains one of the great unanswered questions from Operation Iraqi Freedom. But just to go further, if you remember that in 2004, about a year after Baghdad fell, there was an intercepted terrorist attack from Syria into Jordan using chemical weapons. If the chemical weapons had detonated in the capital of Jordan, Amman, which is where they were heading, the estimates had put the potential casualties at 80,000.
80,000? So that's a pretty serious chemical weapon. What are we talking about? Some kind of VX nerve gas or something?
Out of all sorts of things. Amman is a very hilly city, and so if you had these chemical weapons detonated by in trucks in valleys, you could really create a huge problem. The point of this is one of the big policy concerns we should have right now. We have to assume that Syria has biological and chemical weapons, not only from Iraq, but on their own. Now, what are we going to do if we do overthrow the Syrian regime, to really secure those biological weapons. On the other hand, if we sit on the sidelines and do nothing, and al-Qaeda-affiliated groups become increasingly strong inside Syria, then we also risk having these al-Qaeda groups gain access to the biological and chemical weaponry.
I see that actually before Mike was cut off, he had told my producer what he was going to ask, and it was this. If there were weapons of mass destruction on Syrian Scuds aimed at Israel. Now, that's an interesting question. First of all, I didn't know that Syrians had Scuds, which are, of course, these kind of World War II vintage V-2 on steroid rockets that the Iraqis had. So do such weapons exist, Syrian Scuds with chemical or biological weapons at the tip?
We have to assume that they do. Scuds are notoriously inaccurate. The Israelis think that they could probably shoot them down. The question is, what happens to the warhead when it's blown up? Remember, also about a year and a half ago, the Syrians were caught smuggling Scud missiles into Lebanon and providing them to Hezbollah, and that was a whole range of missiles which Hezbollah had never gotten its hands on before.
I have to ask this before we go to the break. That's not like one of those little Katyushin rockets or something. A Scud is pretty big. How do you smuggle something that big without somebody noticing?
Well, the point is someone did notice, which is why it became an issue in the press, but you basically smuggle it in parts.
Okay, very good. More to come. Stay with us. Michael Rubin, our guest, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. What to do about Syria? We'll be back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show, 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626, online at jimbotalk.net. We're talking with resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Rubin, about the situation in Syria, where a lot of countries have kicked out the Syrian ambassador, but whoop-de-doo, so far there's no indication that that's going to change anything, but everybody feels better, I guess, for having done so. I'm wondering about this whole Arab Spring phenomenon. Now that we've got finalists in the Egyptian election and some time to assess what has happened from Tunisia to Libya to Egypt to Yemen or where all, I've lost count. Could you assess the individual parts of Arab Spring to date?
Well, the best situation so far has been in Tunisia. In Tunisia, the Islamist Party did win, although it has made a point of not imposing Islamist social mores on ordinary people. There were factions within that Islamist party, and the most liberal faction won. We'll see whether that still lasts. Because of that, however, the Tunisian economy is in much better shape than in other countries. In many of these other countries, however, Syria and Libya have, of course, been beset by civil war and violence. Yemen is barely recovering, and it's the poorest Arab state to begin with. The situation has been quite bad as it was under the leaders beforehand. In Libya, even though the world attention isn't focused there anymore, you still do have clashes between rival militias. The government has hardly consolidated, and there's real fear that half the country might succeed and go independent. Where else? You have the situation in Bahrain, which is quite messy. It's actually the polar opposite of where we are in Syria, because in Bahrain, you actually have an American naval base, which has become the center of vocal protests and has factored into American strategic thinking. The real problem, however, is Egypt. One out of every three Arabs lives in Egypt, and as you said, the elections don't look like they will be going well. But while we focus on the presidential elections, the second round of which will be in about 2.5 weeks, the fact of the matter is, you already had elections for a parliament which is going to write the constitution, and that parliament is 80% Islamist.
I have to ask you also about the Muslim Brotherhood, which I don't know if they're just disingenuous or can't make up their mind, but in the beginning, of course, it was, well, okay, Mubarak's out, but hey, we don't want to run this place. maybe a cabinet seat, and then more and more. And then they got the parliament, and now there's a real shot that they'll probably get the presidency as well. Can we trust these people when they say that they're not anxious in totally transforming Egypt? And how many moderates are there within the Brotherhood?
Let me answer the question this way. I have a file in my office of Ayatollah Khomeini's statements before he led the Islamic Revolution in Iran, when he was still allowing Western journalists to interview him when he was in Paris briefly. And you have all these British, American, French, Austrian newspapers which are quoting Khomeini as saying, "I have no interest in personal power. I don't want an Islamic state in Iran." But as soon as he went back to Iran and got into power, we saw what happened. I think that there's going to be a lot of egg on a lot of people's faces, especially those specialists who went off and said that the Muslim Brotherhood had really moderated, because in reality, the Muslim Brotherhood were just treating them like useful idiots.
So I guess despite the fact that he was an autocrat, although far from the worst on the planet, if you look at it now from the standpoint of either stability in the region or, frankly, the rights of individual Egyptians, was Mubarak the good old days?
Well, I think the Egyptian-American sociologist Saadeddine Ibrahim put it best when he said, in Egypt you have autocrats and you have theocrats. They're really mirror images of each other. The autocrats use all the mechanisms of state. The theocrats use the mosque. They all run on the fear of the other, but they're public enemy number one. Those they target with the most violence are anyone who's liberal and in between, who could provide a third way, an alternative.
How cheery. Well, more to come with Michael Rubin. Stay with us. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show. Michael Rubin, our guest, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. What do you think is going to be the outcome in Syria, and can this just drag on for months and months?
Well, the danger is we assume that Assad is going to fall eventually. But remember, Saddam Hussein in 1991 survived an uprising in which 14 out of 18 governorates were against him. We need to ask ourselves what the cost of Bashar al-Assad remaining in power like a bleeding ulcer would be. It really would undercut stability, and it would result in even more Iranian force on the Mediterranean. That's what we're up against.
Despite our distaste for military action, particularly following Iraq and Afghanistan, is that the lesser of several evils in terms of policy options?
Increasingly, I do think it is. Remember, we have proof from the Iraq war, when we seized a computer, that Bashar al-Assad was complicit with al-Qaeda suicide bombers. And at the same time, in 2007, the Israelis took out a secret plutonium plant in Syria. This is a regime which is very, very dangerous, even at the best of times. Now they're a wounded lion.
And that, of course, brings up the next question so many times in that neck of the woods. Whenever you have a sticky point, why, you just turn to the old LIDI solution. Let Israel do it. Is there anything here that we would let them do? Obviously, they're preoccupied with Iran at the moment, but they've had pretty good success kicking Syrian butt over the years.
I think in this case, it would be let Turkey do it. That's because you're exactly right. The Iranians are preoccupied with
the Israelis, yeah.
And the Turks and the Syrians have even greater animosity right now. In fact, Turkey has been threatening to invoke NATO Article 5, which, for self-defense, every time a Syrian shell goes across the border. If Turkey does that, we either need to go to war against Syria, or we need to tell Turkey we don't really take you seriously as a part of NATO anymore.
Wow, that would be an interesting development in and of itself. But looking at maybe beating a dead horse here, but has this again dramatically demonstrated the impotence of the United Nations?
It most certainly has. What this reminds me of, look, Kofi Annan, the former UN Secretary General, is in charge of the UN efforts on Syria. Remember what he did before he became Secretary General. He was in charge of refugee affairs and peacekeeping in Rwanda in 1994. It was under his watch that 800,000 Rwandans were killed. He later apologized for that. He seems to, however, be making the same mistake twice.
The entire approach here in this region of the world, it seems, I guess, absent any real controls. The people who have the power to do something lack the will. Isn't that pretty much where we stand?
That is exactly where we stand. And if we just go back to Kofi Annan, he released the budget that he would need for the coming year, which included $80,000 for remodeling his office. And this is what the United Nations is about today.
Okay, I cannot think of a better way in which to wrap this up. Stay on the line. We'll speak off air. Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. He studies this region of the world, the Middle East, special focus on Iran, Iraq, Turkey, and the Kurdish society, and more to come. I'm Jim Bohannon on the Dial Global Radio Networks.